And that brings us to the close of another radio program. Behind us right now is Rick Ruskin from a Tacoma LP put out in 1977 called the Six String Conspiracy LP. Don't believe I need to tell you the title of this piece. Maurizio Abate with a beautiful acoustic guitar performance on a track called Nymph's Dance that came out in 2017 on the Italian Boring Machines label. LP is called Standing Waters. And we heard the band Friendship at the top of that set from a new Merge release called Caveman Wakes Up. The track was called Tree of Heaven. My name is Scott. I enjoy being with you here every Monday. Thank goodness we got each other, friends. Be well, and look forward to seeing you again next week with my special guests, Royal Arctic Institute. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Mark Hurst is next with Tectonic. Bye. Hey, everybody.
Welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I will be your host for the next hour. Thanks so much for joining. And I hope you are enjoying our new theme song, composed and created by Kirk Pearson. Thanks to Kirk for that. If you missed last week's episode, I spoke with Kirk, or actually Kirk provided us with a How It's Made audio tour of how they put together the theme song, and it's worth listening to. And at the end of that episode, I also went through some alternatives to big tech. And so we're starting this week's show with Kirk's theme song, as we're going to be doing from now on. And much like last week's episode, in which I talked about big tech alternatives, I've got an interview for you today that is all about alternatives, alternative ways of thinking about networks. We're going to be speaking with Laurie Emerson, who's the author of a really beautiful new book called Other Networks, a Radical Technology Sourcebook. I'm going to play this interview with Laurie here in a moment, but I just want to set it up by saying, if you think about how long human beings have been creating networks, I know if someone says, what's a network you can think of today, you might think of the telephone network, or, I mean, obviously a lot of people are going to mention the internet. Maybe you think of cable TV networks. I mean, we have some of these contemporary networks that we're very familiar with, but cast your memory back even further, your historical memory, and think back, what's the earliest networks that humans created? And you'll hear at the beginning of the interview that we talk about the earliest entry in Laurie's book, where she's talking about other networks. And it's something that is so early, we don't even know how early it started. I mean, it's way, way back in the mists of prehistory. And as we go through this conversation, I want you to consider the idea that making networks, that is sending signals to one another, communicating with each other at a distance, is one of the main things that we do as a species. And it has to have been one of the first things that we did when we started organizing into little communities, making networks. And the point that I think Laurie is driving at in this book, and I hope you'll see that we're trying to get to that in this upcoming interview that I'm going to play for you, is that the networks we have today, chief among them the internet, are not the only ways for us to build networks. Even today, with all the technology that we have available, we don't have to accept the corporate surveilling internet, the big tech dominated toxic sludge infected internet, as our only option. There are other models out there for us to learn from and maybe even build towards. And so that's a thought I want you to consider as I play this interview with Laurie Emerson. If you want links to Laurie's site and the book, and there's a couple of images of the book on the playlist, go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and click the playlist link for the Laurie Emerson episode, and it's all there. Let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Laurie Emerson here on Tectonic. Laurie Emerson, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you for having me, Mark.
Let's talk about your new book, Other Networks, a Radical Technology Sourcebook. It's published by Anthology Editions over in Brooklyn. I would describe this book as an encyclopedia of networks, past and present, with dozens of entries, starting with talking drums and moving all the way through radio, telegraph, cable TV, all the way to imaginary networks like the cosmic internet. You must have had a clear vision to put together such an ambitious work. You write in the book that you want to, quote, reawaken our sense of possibility by the excavation of networks from the past.
Yeah, well, I think I initially had the idea for the project back in maybe 2016, right when the news was breaking about the funding behind Facebook manipulating elections and so on. And I think at the same time as I was tinkering around in my own media archaeology lab, and I was really obsessed with hardware and software, I started to think more about what are the networks? What are the networks that I could start to uncover, excavate in and through the lab? And the book was driven by my enthusiasm for the possibilities, but also maybe my ignorance and some hubris, and that I thought that this was a totally doable project and I could crank this out in a year. And I've just talk about a bunch of different networks. And pretty much the minute I started working on the project, I realized how the landscape of other networks, alternative networks, goes back to the beginning of human civilization, and that my goal of including all of these incredible, wild, wonderful networks from other cultures and other times, other countries, was not really going to be achievable, but I could delve into it a little bit. And at the same time, I've been picking away at reading Black radical thinkers who identify with Afrofuturism. And I think I'd really started to become convinced that we don't necessarily need more dire warnings about the state of things. For sure, between 2016, which I think was a big awakening for most people, understanding what was happening with social media, and 2020, 2021, the tide started to turn, and I would say the majority of internet users started to understand what a problem the internet was. But over and over again, nobody seemed to know what to do. And, while I'm teaching 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, it was making me so sad to see how they were passively accepting the situation. They're like, yeah, I'm just going to be surveilled for the rest of my life. That's just what it is. And they had no sense of how networks or how the internet could be something other than this corporate surveilled hellscape. And every time I would introduce them just a little bit to a very simple alternative way of communicating with their friends, it was just so beautiful and joyful and heartening to see their faces light up as they're using, walkie-talkies to talk to their friends, or they're playing around with mesh networks on our one laptop per child computers. So anyway, that's generally the impetus behind the book and where I think I'm probably going to continue for the rest of my career if I can.
And we should mention that your career is at University of Colorado at Boulder, where you head up the Media Archaeology Lab. I want to get back to the book, but just say a little bit about what the lab does.
Well, the lab has been around since 2009. And I think the reason why it's lasted this long and turned into such a weird, wonderful, joyful, playful space is that it largely has not been beholden to major grants, university initiatives. I just started it on my own. And it's over the years, it's largely been driven by donations from wonderful people all over the world and from volunteers, both students here on campus and people working in the tech industry in Boulder. And what it is a place where you can have hands-on access to technology that goes back to the 19th century. Everything that's in the lab works and is really meant to be played with, experimented with. People use it for research. They use it for teaching. They use it for art projects. They use it for making music. And they also just use it for enjoyment. It's a weird little space on campus that's also porous. It's open to everybody. It's open to members of the public. We have seniors groups come. We have tourists from the other side of the country pop in the lab to check it out. So yeah, the goal with the lab is not only just to teach people about the history of technology, but to also give them a sense of empowerment as they can see how cool things were in the past and how cool things could be again in the future, and to actually, yeah, to empower them rather than to leave them resigned to the state of things.
Okay, let's get to some of these entries that you've written in other networks. All the entries are organized into four main categories: wireless networks, wired networks, hybrid networks, and imaginary networks. And inside some of those categories are sections like water networks, optical networks, and so on. And each individual entry in the book lists country of origin for that network, the creator or creators, earliest known use, basic infrastructure or materials, related entries, which is to say other entries in the book that readers can explore that have some tangential or related subject matter, the description, which is your long description of what the network is, and then sources that you drew on. So this is a pretty comprehensive look at each one of these entries that you've put together. You mentioned earlier that you discovered in your research that networks are an ancient activity for humans, and appropriately enough, the entry that starts off the book is talking drums, which you list as unknown country of origin, unknown creator, unknown earliest known use, although you do mention the use in Africa. And then drums is followed by whistling, which you write is a form of communication over distances up to 8 kilometers, which is a surprise to me. They didn't go that far. And then you cover fire or smoke signals dating back to ancient Greece. That's 300 BCE. I was interested in this entry because we recently saw this in the news from the Vatican as the white smoke emerged from the chimney above the Sistine Chapel, indicating the election of the new pope. So these early entries in the book are reminding us that building networks must have been one of the earliest things we did as humans, and some of those same networks are still in use today.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I cannot believe, or I guess I should believe, that my book is already out of date, because I mentioned in the entry that it was the fire or smoke signals was a practice that began in 1914 and was used as recently as 2013. Yes. And just to go back to the drum communication, to be honest, even to this day, I am blown away by how incredibly efficient and fast drum communication was and still is. I discovered this African scholar, I don't know how to pronounce his name properly, but his last name is Zulu, and he had an unpublished manuscript that I think he had put online, maybe academia.edu or ResearchGate, something like that. And he had figured out that in the early 20th century, there were such elaborate drum communication networks set up that spanned the entire girth of Africa, from West Africa to East Africa, that these networks had been set up to communicate, about colonial incursions, that they could travel something like 1,000 kilometers per hour, making it faster than a 777 Boeing jet, which is just incredible. So by far the fastest kind of communication possible.
After these early technologies, you move into more recent networks. And I was happy to see several entries having to do with radio. Here we are on community radio right now. And in the entry on pirate radio, you say that pirate radio, of course, refers to the unlicensed use of radio waves. And then you go on to say something I didn't realize, that the United States instituted radio licenses after the Titanic disaster. The entry also mentions Radio Caroline, the radio station that was famously based on a ship in international waters, which, as you say, transmitted off the European coast from 1964 through the late 1960s. And reading about you, Laurie, on your own website, laurieemerson.net, I learned that you recently became an amateur radio operator. Was the radio research in the book the driver for you to get into amateur radio, or did you become an amateur radio operator in order to complete the book's research?
That's a great question. I don't really know which one came first. They happened at the same time and fed into each other. And I always have what I think are very clear, coherent plans for my research. And then as soon as I start doing it, instantly just like falls apart as I realize that things are way more complicated than they are. But my goal with getting my amateur radio license, I think initially was just to see like, can I do this thing that, you know, I was raised to believe I really had no business doing. I think it's hard for especially young women today to understand what it was like being someone like me, born in 1974, raised on a fairly remote area of Vancouver Island in the 1970s and the 1980s with a very conventional gendered upbringing where I was expected to play with dolls and play piano. And I did actually enjoy both of those activities, but I also enjoyed doing the things that my brother was busy doing, like he had a microscope and we would make crystals together and do little science experiments and build stuff with tinker toys. Anyway, I think even though I've really had no training in electronics or building things in my life, I am so committed to the idea that we should know how to build things and that this is something that we ought to be passing on to young people that I really force myself to learn how radio works from the ground up and get my license and even got my general license. I haven't done much with it yet. But yeah, it started off with a challenge to myself to see whether I could do it. To my surprise, I could do it. To my greater surprise, I generally understood what was going on. I understood the basics, I think, of the electromagnetic spectrum. And by the time I finished writing the wireless network entries, I was really, and I still am, completely convinced that radio is the future. And I say this now all the time to the young people that I'm in touch with. And so my long-term hope is that Libby, who helps me run the Media Archaeology Lab, and I will start offering training to young people to get more and more people licensed so that we can kind of like pull this the culture of amateur radio away from the survivalists and the preppers and the white guy engineers, God bless them. And show people that, you know, radio is an incredible, potentially liberatory way of communicating that we could all take up on our own and just, yeah, learn to communicate outside the internet.
Radio is the future. That's going to be music to the ears of many listeners. And you're also bringing up in this book that radio was an important part of the past as well. The entries in the book are not simply the amateur radio and pirate radio. I was really intrigued by the entry called Meteor Burst Communication. This is also known as ionospheric scatter and meteor scatter communications. This I had never heard of. This is a system that uses the trails of meteors to bounce radio signals from one place to another. You write that meteor burst communication was no doubt popular due to the fact that MBC systems should be able to survive a nuclear war. And that,
yes,
that came up a couple of times. Some of these networks were designed in case of nuclear war and all the existing radio networks are taken out. What can we use? I know, when a meteor streaks across the sky, we can bounce signals off of its tail.
Mm-hmm. It's wild and unfortunately becoming ever more relevant once again.
I've got another example. This was Project West Ford. If it's okay with you, Lori, I'd like to just read some of this entry because you wrote it so clearly and it's such a bananas idea that actually took place. You write, Project West Ford, originally named Project Needles, was an intentionally short-lived Cold War era experiment first imagined by electrical engineer Walter Morrow and then undertaken by MIT's Lincoln Laboratory in the early 1960s. And I'll just jump in here to skip ahead a bit. The basic idea was that in the event of nuclear war, there it is again, the U.S. government would need a way to communicate with all the radio networks down. And so this guy, Walter Morrow, came up. It's hard to say with a straight face. He came up with the idea to launch copper needles or small copper fibers into space. And we're talking hundreds of millions of copper needles.
And then 480 million.
480 million. And then have them orbit the Earth in one band, creating, as you say, a donut-shaped belt of 480 million copper fibers or needles, each of which was 0.7 inches long, orbiting the Earth at an altitude of 2,237 miles. And then in May 1963, you write that they actually pulled it off. They launched the copper needles into orbit. It formed the donut. The space donut is operational. And that enabled radio communication between California and Massachusetts. The donut kind of had a north-south shape to it, and so you could bounce signals in the middle of the country up in space. And you write in closing that, quote, Project West Ford's needle clusters still orbit the Earth as space debris.
I'm so glad you noticed this entry and you loved it, because I remember at the time I discovered this, I was just sitting in the coffee shop constantly going, what? They did what? Yeah, it's mind-blowing.
How often did you have that experience as you're doing this research, coming across networks that I would think very few people today have any knowledge of, and unearthing these wild stories?
Almost daily. So I worked on this book for about 3 years every day for 4 to 6 hours a day. And every day was a journey of having my mind blown, either by discovering a network that existed that's only mentioned in some very obscure government manual published in some other country in, you know, 1962. Or what would often happen too is that I would discover that what we thought was, we all knew the history of, let's say, radio broadcasting or television, actually turned out to be something very different, very heterogeneous, and very odd. Another example of this was, I think it was Radiofax, was the one where for a brief time newspapers were broadcasting the news over the radio via facsimile. And so there's these pictures of children receiving long spools of news out of the radio that's situated in the living room. And I just had no idea. I had no idea that this existed.
And we're back. If you have just tuned in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Laurie Emerson, who's the author of a fascinating new book called Other Networks, a Radical Technology Sourcebook. It's published by Anthology Editions. And if you'd like a look at the book, both the cover and a couple of interior pages, go to the Tectonic playlist at tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and click the playlist link for Laurie Emerson. Let's go ahead now and listen to the second half of my interview with Laurie Emerson here on Tectonic. You mentioned the images, and that reminds me, I just want to bring up, this is a beautifully designed book. It is hardcover, but the format is larger than normal. This one is at 9.5 by 11 inches, and it's got lots of archival images, both black and white and full color. For example, I appreciated that there was a double page spread showing a pneumatic tube station at Sears Roebuck in Chicago, and also at the beginning of the water networks section, you had a full page woodcut, a beautiful woodcut of something called a hydraulic semaphore from ancient Greece. This was a device I hadn't previously ever heard of. I wanted to ask, how did you make the decision to publish in a larger format with such lush images, and was that difficult to pull off?
Yeah, thank you for asking me about this. It gives me an opportunity to talk about what an incredible once-in-a-lifetime opportunity it was to work with Anthology Editions on this book. A lot of the design of the book was very collaborative. Mark Iosifescu, I've never been able to pronounce his last name properly. I'm really sorry, Mark, who is my editor, was just wonderful, so wonderful to work with. And we also got to work with two book designers. So one, Robert Beatty, designed the book cover, and he also designed the section representations of networks. And Ella Gold did the interior design. So she made all the decisions about the images and which ones were going to be full spread and which ones were going to be color and that sort of thing. But I had the opportunity to meet with the team regularly and give my input, especially my vision for the book, which I don't know whether this came through, but what I really wanted was a book that recalled late 19th century, early 20th century, cloth bound, hardcover, like a combination of old Wizard of Oz books, but also telegraph manuals and telephone manuals where they had that beautiful font on the front and often gold foil or something like that. And my thought was to recall that, but to sort of like create a past that never existed and to somehow feminize it. So originally the plan was for the cover to be hot pink. And I could not believe that everyone was game to give it a hot pink cover, but we had to switch printers at the last minute because the book was censored in China. And so now it's a rust-colored red. But anyway, it's supposed to evoke a past that didn't exist. Yeah, should we talk about censorship?
Yeah, because I've done shows on censorship in China, and I'm just trying to figure out, was it the hot pink that got the censors in a tizzy over there? Or did they demand that it have more of a red color, which is a proper color?
It almost seemed like the censors actually read the book, which I was surprised. And they found a very brief mention of the use of facts by student protesters in Hong Kong, using facts to send news of the Tiananmen Square massacre to people in mainland China. So that's what did it. I guess I had the opportunity to take that reference out, but I chose not to.
Excellent. Excellent choice. I admire that. I have covered China and the authoritarian regime and the censorship there on a number of shows, one of which was Ian Johnson, who wrote a book called Sparks on the underground historians in China, which reminds me of your entry on the sneaker net. And you do mention pro-democracy activists bringing in USB drives to authoritarian countries, either behind the Iron Curtain or into North Korea. And that's essentially what continues today to happen in China, as historians who otherwise would be censored or worse are sharing their hard-won knowledge and research with others via Sneakernet. And for listeners who don't know what Sneakernet is, well, you can read the book, but I'll just tell you. It's when you walk around in your sneakers and hand somebody a physical media like a flash drive or a CD or something. Well, Lori, let's cover a couple more of these entries. I could talk with you well beyond this hour on what you have in this book, but let me just highlight a couple. One is barbed wire networks. This was a section that had two entries. One was barbed wire telegraph, and the other was fence phones. For the telegraph, my question is, why were two guys in Wilmington, Massachusetts in 1904, trying to build a telegraph network using barbed wire?
I don't know. And I don't know that I ever came across an explanation. It seemed like one of those quintessential stories of just like two guys messing around and wanting to know whether it was possible to do this thing. That's about as much information as I ever gleaned from that.
I guess the idea was
There's a lot of barbed wire in these here parts. It's metal. It should transmit messages well. And so we don't have to string up or dig a trench to lay any cable.
Yeah.
And so let's try it. And if I remember right from the entries, it kind of sort of worked locally, right?
I think it did. Yeah.
And I guess if that was 1904, I'm guessing it was those guys' grandsons who decided to put copper needles in space just because it would be fun.
It had to have been. That's exactly right.
And then the very end of the book, you're going into these imaginary networks. Each one of these is a gem. I wanted to highlight faster than light communication networks. The creator is listed as Albert Einstein. I wanted to bring this up because this actually came up in conversation with friends. It came up that quantum entanglement allows these quantum particles to operate in sync at arbitrarily long distances instantaneously. It's called spooky action at a distance. That's sort of the informal term that physicists use for this. And you write about this, quantum entanglement, as the possible basis. Again, this is in a section called imaginary networks. So this hasn't been built. But you write that it could be possible for a network to be built out of this idea that quantum particles at a long distance could be synchronized in a way to transmit a message, which would then allow us to transmit information faster than light. And I wanted to ask, since the book came out, have you heard anything else about this? You left it as an open question in the entry, but do you know anything else about this possibility?
I haven't heard anything else since the book came out, but I wouldn't be surprised if it does become a possibility, because as you might have noticed, there's an entry on telepathy in the book. And who would have thought that telepathic communication would ever be proved by scientists? But I did find an article from 2014 that supposedly proves that brain-to-brain communication is possible. So I wouldn't be surprised.
I was really interested in that. That was the next one I was going to bring up, partly because of that interesting mention of that source that you just described, but also for the very disturbing two-page spread that you have following, which is a diagram showing BCI, brain-computer interface. And this has also come up on past shows because the idea of, I mean, we can call it telepathy, but really it's, I've got a surveillance chip in my brain, you have a surveillance chip in your brain, and they have Bluetooth. And so we can share the surveilled thoughts in our minds with each other over this link. And that is just money for guys like Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk, both of whom are literally working on this technology as we speak. So this is one where the imaginary network is one where I'm saying, let's not build this one. I like the idea of, I don't know, organic telepathy, the original kind, but I don't really like the idea of big tech companies surveilling our thoughts and broadcasting that to others.
No kidding. And didn't I see a few years ago, headlines about how monkeys who had Neuralink implanted in them were going crazy?
There's all sorts of issues that have come up. Neuralink has been covered in a couple of deep dive articles, and what they found is that Neuralink doesn't really want to talk about what happened to the monkeys. It's bad. It's bad.
Yeah. We could talk about snails.
Oh, yes. The snails. Tell us about the snails. This imaginary network, there was a visionary who was sure that snails had a way of communicating.
Yeah. You know, I should say that also in the course of doing research for other networks, I came across so many examples of animal cruelty en route to, you know, experimenting with networks. But yeah, in 1850, somebody named Jacques Toussaint Benoit was convinced that in the course of mating, that snails transmitted sympathetic fluids telepathically. And so he thought it would be a great idea if he got 26 snails, one for each letter of the alphabet, glued them to the bottom of a bowl, and electrocuted each one of them in order to force them to transmit a message telepathically. And he did this experiment in front of a reporter for Le Monde, and, you know, no big surprise, it was a failure. But yes, this is called the Pasolinic Sympathetic Compass. And yeah, it still blows my mind, and it's so cruel. And it also reminds me of all those experiments done on poor dolphins in the 1950s and the 1960s, kind of at a very similar belief that dolphin communication could somehow lead us to understand telepathic communication, and or could lead us to figure out how to communicate with aliens. And so many dolphins died during these experiments. It's really truly heartbreaking.
I guess I shouldn't be laughing about the snail experiments, but there's just something.
It's just bananas.
It's just, I feel bad for the snails, okay, but just imagining the pitch. Okay, hear me out now. I'm into snails, and I'm into snails when they're mating. And I really think that as snails are mating, there's a telepathic connection. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take some glue, and I'm going to glue these snails to the bottom of this bowl here. Just stay with me. Why are you leaving? Stay with me. And I've got this. This one is A. This one is B. All the way to Z. I mean, there are stories in this book, as you say, that blow your mind about how people have attempted to build networks in the past, or even to conceive of ideas of networks. And in some cases, like the copper needles, have actually succeeded in building a space donut of copper around the Earth.
Yeah.
I should add, it's not all wacky stuff. I mean, you have very sober and clear accounts of where radio came from, where TV came from. I love the articles on the library and the book as networks in themselves. So there's a lot for people to explore here. And you actually wrote an interesting exercise for how people can explore these entries. I found this on a post you wrote on your site a few months ago in March 2025. And here's what you wrote. Step one, place a kitchen timer on a chair or stool and set it to 30 minutes. Step two, take no more than 1 minute to choose an other network. That means choose one of the entries in the book. Step three, read out loud any information on the network for no more than 4 minutes. Step four, choose a related network and repeat steps two and three no more than 5 times. So what you're saying here is when you read the entry, go to the related entries section and find something that is, again, tangentially interesting to you and read that one. And then you say, stop reading out loud when the kitchen timer goes off and repeat as many times as necessary for you to begin imagining a future beyond the internet. I just thought, what a great exercise for us to do in this environment of, as you said earlier, this corporatized, surveillance-laden monoculture online, for us to imagine some other future. And so I wanted to ask you, Lori, after doing all this research, writing this book, how do you imagine a future beyond the internet?
As in, what do I imagine it to be?
Oh, however you want to answer it. I mean, you wrote this very compelling exercise for people to read entries in the book and read related entries, read them out loud until they begin to imagine a future beyond the internet. You must have had that experience yourself going through this research and writing process. How has it changed you or your outlook on the internet?
I'm so glad that you found that. I think I called it a recipe for a performance, because it shows all of the different facets of my thinking that are coming together in this book. And something that we didn't get a chance to talk about today is the role of artists. And I think that the future of networks is actually kind of, it's recovering an artist's sensibility combined with opening up, making accessible engineering in a way that it's never really been accessible. It could become accessible. And I think the way artists have approached networks as sites of experimentation and intervention is the perfect model for thinking beyond the internet. combined with a type of pedagogy that's very invested in learning things hands-on and learning things from the ground up. So while I do believe that the future of networks beyond the internet is in radio, it could be in anything. And in many ways, these incredible artists from the last, let's say, 150 years really provide us a roadmap with what that kind of open-ended, playful, creative experimentation with networks looks like.
You write online that, quote, the internet as we know it is not a foregone conclusion. Indeed, the present corporatized, monolithic, surveilled state of our networked communications is just one possibility out of many, and there is radical promise in uncovering hidden alternatives. I would say, Lori, that this book gives us that chance to uncover hidden alternatives and build something better. The book is Other Networks, a Radical Technology Sourcebook by you, Lori Emerson, and published by Anthology Editions. Lori, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Mark. It was a real pleasure.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I will be your host for the remaining 15 or so minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Lori Emerson, who's the head of the Media Archaeology Lab there at University of Colorado at Boulder, and has come out with a fascinating new book called Other Networks, a Radical Technology Sourcebook, which we just talked about. And as we mentioned, it's published by Anthology Editions right here in the neighborhood of where I am, not far away in Brooklyn. So nice job to Lori. Nice job to Anthology Editions. Just a great piece of work that I'd recommend taking a look at if you are interested in other networks, which I think you should be. I think everyone should be. I liked what Lori said at some point in the book. I annotated and I saved off this quote, which is that the book challenges us, quote, to think harder about where networks are, how they work, how they are connected to one another, who owns them, and even whether we can build our own. And all of those are important considerations for us to think about as we explore these networks, both the ones that affect us on a day-to-day basis, but also as we imagine other networks that may be possible to either conceive or maybe bring back from the past or maintain and amplify if they are still in use today. Amateur radio is a great example of that. I love that Lori became an amateur radio operator as she created this book. And as Lori said, and here's a poll quote for today's show, isn't it? Radio is the future. I should have the reverb on when I say that. Radio is the future. And what Lori said in the interview is that we can learn to communicate outside the internet. And how important is that for us to have alternatives? Like I said at the top of the show, last week's show, I talked about alternatives to the toxic, monopolistic, manipulative, exploitative big tech platforms and sites and apps. And I gave a list of non-big tech, non-monopolistic and so on platforms that do the same things as the big tech platforms do. And by the way, you can find that past show at tectonic.fm. It's there, and you're very welcome to listen to it, tectonic.fm. That's the one with the new theme song with Kirk Pearson and Big Tech Alternatives. But the thing about those alternatives is that presupposes that we are going to stay online, that we're going to continue using the internet to communicate with each other, which, by the way, I like the internet and I like those big tech alternatives. So this is not about, I'm not driving at a point here of abandoning the internet, but I like what Lori is saying, that there are alternatives for us outside of the internet, radio being foremost among them, at least as she argues. And I think it's a very compelling argument. Radio is the future. I mean, just think about it. As you listen to the radio, if you happen to be listening on an FM band, you are not being surveilled. Nobody knows that you are listening to that particular show or song or station or whatever. It's just broadcast out and you can pick it up if you want it. That's totally different from the other end of the spectrum is if you listen to anything at all on something like Spotify, every tiny little thing you do on Spotify is being surveilled. So I like the idea that radio is the future because there is a path forward without big tech. And part of that future, I don't think the totality, but part of that future exists for us outside of the internet. And this book, Other Networks, gives us lots and lots of ideas of where that could be. Just don't, please, do not glue snails to the bottom of a bowl. Let's not pursue that idea. But the space donut, you know, that's still up there. It's already been built. It's already been floated up there. It's space debris just waiting for people to bounce messages off of it. So listeners, go at it. You know, make use of the space donut. It's there. The last thing I want to point out here is when we talk about alternatives, we have to think, alternative to what? What is our current path that we're on? And are we real clear on why we need alternatives? And I don't know where you're listening from, but I will say I'm in the New York, New Jersey area, and today just happened to be a very hot and humid day. One of those really unpleasant scorchers that the East Coast sometimes gets in the summer. And of course, there was a message. I don't know if I saw it as a text or email or something, but something came from some part of the city government asking New York citizens, please be judicious in your use of your air conditioning because, you know, the power grid is vulnerable and so on. And I get that. And I want to be a good citizen. And I don't want to use too much energy for my AC. I get all that. So I'm on board. But I just want to point out that in many parts of the U.S. and other countries, a sizable percentage of the power grid is now being devoted to powering AI big data centers that are owned and operated by the same toxic big tech companies that we're trying to get away from by building out these alternatives. There's this great article in MIT's Technology Review, and I've put this on the playlist at tectonic.fm. TECH tonic.fm. This is dated May 20, 2025. And the headline is, "We did the math on AI's energy footprint. Here's the story you haven't heard." And it says, I would recommend, friends, clicking through and reading that story if you have time, if you're at all interested, because it really breaks down as a comprehensive look at the energy draw of big tech AI data centers. And again, it's that draw that is contributing to cities around the world asking their citizens not to turn up their ACs too high because we have to reserve the power for the slop factories. Let me just read you a little bit of what this tech review piece said. Quote, "Let's say you're running a marathon as a charity runner and organizing a fundraiser to support your cause. You ask an AI model 15 questions about the best way to fundraise. Then you make 10 attempts at an image for your flyer." Here they're talking about using an AI, generative AI engine to make images. "Then you make 10 attempts at an image for your flyer before you get one you are happy with, and 3 attempts at a 5-second video to post on Instagram." Again, that's talking about generative AI services to make a video. Here's what Tech Review says. You would use about 2.9 kilowatt hours of electricity, enough to ride over 100 miles on an e-bike, or around 10 miles in the average electric vehicle. And that's 60 kilometers on an e-bike or 6 kilometers in the average electric vehicle. Or that's enough electricity to run the microwave for, take a guess, over 3.5 hours. 3.5 hours of microwave use in order to ask the AI a few questions, make a couple of attempts at a slop image, and then to create a slop video. And later in the article, it says, the researchers were clear that adoption of AI and the accelerated server technologies that power it have been the primary force causing electricity demand from data centers to skyrocket after remaining stagnant for over a decade. Between 2024 and 2028, the share of U.S. electricity going to data centers may triple from its current 4.4% to 12%. So Tech Review, their best research, predicts that by 2028, 12% of all U.S. electricity could be going to the big tech data centers where they're creating slop to ruin the internet. And so just think about that. And I don't say this that, you know, if you use AI to ask a question, you're a bad person. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying we should get clear on what the system is and what it's doing to our society, to our power grid, and how that rebounds onto all of us when we're told not to turn our AC too high on a hot day because it's unspoken. We have to protect the power grid for the big tech companies. That's where we're headed. And that, friends, that is why we need other networks. And I thank Lori Emerson again for being on the show. And if you want links to Lori's site and the book and this Tech Review piece, go find the playlist at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. And you can also reach me at mark@wfmu.org. And let's imagine better networks. Let's imagine a better future that is free from the hegemony and the general destruction of these big tech, monopolistic, unethical beasts. And if we work together, we can do that. I do have some homework for you for next time, friends. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, friends, get off Google. And I want you to stay tuned for Dave Mandel, who I'm sure you can handle. He's got a show called It's Complicated. It's a prog rock show. He's coming right up in a couple of minutes. And I do want to remind you that you are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. I've got one more Kirk Pearson song to play for you. As I said at the beginning of the show, our new theme song is composed by Kirk. And now I want to finish with a song called Modem of Home, which you heard just a few seconds of at the beginning of the interview. And I thought it'd only be fair, since we're going to be using this at the beginning of interviews, for you to hear the whole thing. So here it is, friends. And hope you have a great week, and I'll see you next time. Thank you.
So many notes. Welcome, greetings, and thanks for tuning in to this week's installment of It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog-adjacent music. I'm your host, Dave Mandel. I'm here at this time every Monday, 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. In case you don't know, our summer schedule is in effect. It started, a couple weeks ago now. So if you're still baffled by who is on when here on the FMU schedule, feel free to go over to our website, WFMU.org, and check it out. Monday evenings are Monday all day, I think. The entire Monday schedule is unchanged. So we're all safe and sound till September when the next schedule change happens. Anyway, I'm going to dive right into the first track. Tonight we're going to hear from a German group, an early 70s German group called Eilif. That's E-I-L-I-F-F, if you're keeping score. You can follow the playlist, the so-called ACU playlist, and also check in, say hello, if you want, on the WFMU ACU playlist / comments board. Go to our website, WFMU.org, click on the link that says playlist and comments, and it'll take you there. And now we go to Germany for this brief message. We'll be right back.